Right across the UK, so conditions turn warmer and settled for most, variable amounts of cloud, but also some good spells of sunshine.
Thanks, Stav. Now on Radio 4, the next part of our Book of the Week, a cautionary tale of poison, betrayal and greed. The Plumstead murder case of 1833 is about to enthral the nation, with young John Bodle suspected of poisoning his wealthy grandfather with a lethal dose of white arsenic. Julian Reintutt reads from The Inheritor's Powder by Sandra Hempel.
On the first day of the inquest at the Plume of Feathers into George Bodle's death, Dr. John Butler gave a brief outline of his part in the events to the coroner, Charles Carter. The next witness was the Woolwich druggist, Joseph Evans. Young John had been to his shop about a fortnight earlier with the schoolmaster, John Watts, and then again on his own. Each time, young John had bought arsenic. Evans said, "I did not weigh it, but gave him about half an ounce wrapped up in paper on which was written the word poison in large letters." On the second occasion, he had purchased about the same quantity of poison. Evans said, "The prisoner mentioned that a number of his fowls had been destroyed by rats." In the 19th century, householders waged a constant battle against the rats, mice, fleas, lice, cockroaches and bedbugs that threatened to overrun their homes, and arsenic was an effective pest killer. Rats were a particular menace, ruining crops, emerging from the sewers in packs, scurrying around under floorboards, gnawing at the wood, fouling food and drink, and attacking people in their homes. In the 18th century, the problem worsened as the traditional black rat was ousted by a bigger, paler, more aggressive species known either as the Norway or Hamburg rat. So countless packets of deadly white powder were to be found lying around in sheds and kitchens across the country. White arsenic was mixed with flour or oatmeal and placed next to mouse and rat holes, stirred into lard or soap, and rubbed onto furniture and mattresses, added to water for washing down floors, and left about the house in solution in saucers. While farmers used the stuff in industrial quantities to protect their crops and as a sheep dip. After the evidence of Evans the druggist, a surprise witness was called. James Marsh, from the Royal Military Academy in Woolwich, described as a practical chemist, came before the court to announce that he had tested the remains of the Bodle's coffee and found that it definitely contained arsenic. There had been no time to carry out the standard experiments, so instead Marsh had turned to an old subjective test. He took some of the suspect coffee grounds, threw them onto the fire, and sniffed the air to see whether or not he could detect a whiff of garlic. He had come to the conclusion that arsenic was present because of a peculiar smell. That, of course, meant a post-mortem. If there was arsenic in the coffee, then a crime had been committed, and one so cold-blooded and careless of human life as to indicate the work of a psychopath. At that point in the proceedings, young John, who had been waiting for some time in the passage with P.C. Morris, was brought in. The Times newspaper pronounced him perfectly firm and unembarrassed. Charles Carter now adjourned the Bodle inquest pending forensic reports. It was agreed that young John should remain in Constable Morris's custody at the policeman's house in Woolwich. On the way there, they stopped for a glass of gin and peppermint at the Mortar Inn. The next morning, the constable went to Middle John's cottage and searched the young man's room, opening a trunk with a key he had taken from John's pocket. Inside was a bottle containing about an inch and a quarter of liquid, another bottle of what looked like some kind of ointment, and two packets of white powder marked with the words "poison" in large letters, one of them open. The policeman put the bottles and packets into the large pocket where he carried his handcuffs and set off for Evans' chemist's shop in Powers Street. On the way, he was sidetracked and spent the rest of the day on a pub crawl of Woolwich and Plumstead. At some stage, while sinking several pots of ale, Morris managed to drop and break one of the bottles. When he did finally venture out of the Red Lion, it was only to progress as far as the Mortar, where he switched from ale to gin and peppermint and entertained his companions by handing round the evidence. Finally, at about 8 o'clock that evening, P.C. Morris arrived at Joseph Evans' shop in Woolwich and showed the chemist what remained of the exhibits after they had been passed around by a group of drunks and dropped on a barroom floor. The druggist agreed that the packets looked very much like the ones he had sold to young John. By the early 19th century, the post-mortem had begun to play a central role in helping to establish cause of death. This was partly because of doctors' growing understanding of the processes or pathology of various diseases and the changes that these diseases brought about in the body. And so, on the night of Thursday, the 7th of November, the day after the coroner adjourned the inquest, three doctors gathered around the body of George Bodle in the farmhouse. In charge of the procedure was Samuel Solly, lecturer in anatomy and physiology at St. Thomas's Hospital Medical School in London. Assisting him were the surgeon John Butler and a Woolwich physician called Francis Bossy. The old man's innards had much to tell. The membrane lining the gullet was inflamed, and the inflammation also ran down the windpipe and into the lungs. The doctors carefully collected the contents of the old man's insides. If they were not absolutely scrupulous in how they handled and stored them, then a clever defence counsel might argue that any traces of poison were the result of contamination. Solly's conclusion was that death was caused by the general disturbance of the constitution produced by the introduction of some irritating matter into the stomach. He believed that the irritating matter was arsenic. With the post-mortem complete, John Butler took the large, clean jar, sealed it firmly, and delivered it personally to the chemist James Marsh at the Woolwich Arsenal. Forensic toxicology was in its infancy, but Marsh was an exceptionally gifted scientist. With the inquest adjourned, he was able to run the basic laboratory tests of the time, not only on Butler's samples, but also on the packets of white powder, the drizzle of liquid from the broken bottle, and the jar of ointment which had, by some miracle, survived the policeman's pub crawl. On the 8th of November, the day after the post-mortem on George Bodle, the Morning Post published a story not carried by any of the other newspapers. The person suspected of the fiend-like deed was the victim's own grandson, whose character in the neighbourhood stands in very bad repute, the paper claimed. In the last paragraph it was stated, "His father, in speaking of the lamentable occurrence, has been heard to declare his opinion that it was the intention of the prisoner to make him the next victim." The following Monday, the 11th of November, the inquest resumed. Early on, an excited crowd gathered outside the Plume of Feathers. The pub's upstairs room set aside for the proceedings was large, but no sooner had the coroner taken his seat than the court was packed, with people spilling out onto the stairs, straining to hear what was going on. The Bodle inquest proved a marathon running the entire week, with the newspapers recording the proceedings almost minute by minute. The likely murder of one member of a wealthy, respected family and the possible hanging of another had caught the imagination of the nation. The first witness was Middle John's servant, Mary Higgins. Mary had been kicking her heels in the poorhouse for the past week by order of the magistrates to stop her colluding with the other witnesses, in particular her master, Middle John. William Noakes, the lawyer for the parish, took her through her story. She described how, on the morning of the 2nd of November, young John had set off in the direction of George Bodle's farm as soon as it grew light. On the day the family fell ill, Mary said she heard the prisoner say he would not mind poisoning anyone he did not like. And there was more. I heard the prisoner say one day the previous week that he wished his grandfather dead, when he should have 1,000 or 100 a year, I don't know which. With the average wage for maids such as Mary much lower than the £6 a year her London counterparts could expect, her vagueness about how much young John stood to gain was unsurprising. The sums were beyond her comprehension. By now, young John had acquired his own lawyer, James Colquhoun, William Noakes's partner. Mary was quite unprepared for Mr. Colquhoun. He started softly enough, but finally he turned on her, suggesting that her entire testimony about young John discussing poison was a pack of lies cooked up by his father. Mary promptly burst into tears. The room at the Plume of Feathers stayed packed almost to suffocation, according to one reporter, and an irritated carter repeatedly had to order the beadle to clear the doorway as the crowds were pressing so heavily against the table that the jury were nearly knocked out of their seats. Dr. Solly repeated his opinion that the farmer's death was due to a general disturbance of the constitution produced by the introduction of some irritating matter into the stomach, and that the irritating matter was arsenic. James Marsh was able to tell the court that the half pint of coffee that George Bodle had consumed would have contained quite enough arsenic to kill him. Next into the witness box was Middle John, and from the outset the father of the accused continued where Mary Higgins had left off, with a narrative that seemed to be steadily lowering a noose over his son's head. It was unusual for the lad to go for the milk, he said. He then related a conversation he had had with his dying father as he sat at his bedside holding his hand. I asked him if he had any suspicion of who had done anything to him. He said he was satisfied it wasn't me. He said, it was your son, John, and I am well convinced he did it. Did you make any answer to it? Asked the coroner. No, I did not. It was in a low tone of voice, and I could only just hear what my father said. I was obliged to put my ear close to his mouth. But when the charwoman, Mrs. Lear, was called, she flatly contradicted his version of events. She was constantly by the old man's bedside as he died, and if the conversation with Middle John had taken place, she would have heard it. At no time, she added, did Middle John lower his head to speak to his father. If Middle John and Mary Higgins had been trying to collude, they failed wretchedly. On the strength of the contradictory stories about who said what and when, the coroner recalled Middle John and pushed him hard. Middle John repeated his father's suspicions regarding young John being responsible for the poisoning of his father, George Bodle, and refused to be drawn further. Tensions in the upstairs room of the Plume of Feathers were now at fever pitch.
Julian Reintut reading from The Inheritor's Powder by Sandra Hempel, abridged by Libby Spurrier. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4. The producer was David Blount. And tomorrow, the coroner's jury delivers its verdict. Well, we've almost reached the end of the night here on Radio 4. Just the shipping bulletin to come after some sailing by. BBC Radio 4, it's 12 minutes to 1. Now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday the 19th of September. There are warnings of gales in Shannon, Rockall and Malin. The general synopsis at 1800. Developing Atlantic low, moving rather quickly east, expected Scotland 999 by 1800 Thursday. Low, Fair Isle, 991, moving away slowly northwards. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira. Cyclonic, mainly southeasterly, 5 or 6, becoming westerly, 4. Thundery showers, moderate or good. South Utsira, westerly or southwesterly, 4 or 5. Thundery showers, moderate or good. 40s, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne, Dogger. Westerly.